Welcome to EB5 Investment Voice, where attorney insights intersects with immigration investments. If you are a foreign investor, domestic fund manager, or enterprising entrepreneur and want to get the most out of the EB5 program, you have come to the right place. I'm Mark Deal, and I'll be your co-host on this journey. I'm joined by your host, Mona Shaw, and other attorneys at Mona Shaw & Associates, as well as immigration leaders from around the world. So let's get into EB5 Investment Voice. Mona, Rebecca, this EB5 Reform and Integrity Act, there's a lot going on. It's very confusing. First off, it's a mouthful. Is there anything else I can say other than EB5 Reform and Integrity Act?
Well, actually, Mark, yes. You probably hear the acronym RIA. RIA, and that's what the industry is calling this, because, yeah, it is a huge mouthful. And as for confusion, well, Rebecca, do you know any EB5 attorney who really understands all that is going on?
Oh, I don't think so. I think every day we discuss, there's new topics, there's new issues coming up, public policy. You know, with IUSA, we're coming up with different issues all the time with the new regulations.
Well, Mark, today we actually thought a person who has a lot of job projects potentially in set-asides regions is Bill Gresser. And Bill's been on our show before, but it was a long time ago when we had done a special edition following an event in London. I don't know if you remember that.
Yeah, Bill, welcome back to the show. For those that may not remember you, Bill Gresser is the president and founder of EB5 New York State LLC, where he has managed the successful completion of numerous EB5 investment projects and has helped EB5 investors and their families achieve their immigration and investment objectives. And Bill's also the vice president and member of the board of directors of Invest in the USA, which is IIUSA for those of us in the know. Bill, welcome back to the show.
Thank you. Thank you. It's great to be here.
Bill, you are a fountain of knowledge. And actually, Rebecca had a really good comment, which we were discussing before. Rebecca, you wanted to know, what is the point of set-asides, right?
Yes, I think there's a lot of confusion, which we can go through what the set-asides are a bit later. But Bill, what do you think this is a good policy?
That's a great question, Rebecca. And I mean, it's funny. It's one of those questions. Is it a good policy or a bad policy? I guess at the end of the day, I don't know that it really matters as a policy, whether it's good or bad, because it's the law. And so the RIA, or RIA, it says there are reserve visas. And so we operate within that framework that Congress created. Whether it's good or bad, it just is a fact.
Yeah, that is a point. There's a way of moving around laws, but maybe that's something for the future. there is a confusion, and we are getting it from all angles, whether it is agents or developers or investors themselves across the board. They're like, oh, this is a set-aside. And now it appears that everything is almost a set-aside, which is just obviously not the purpose of this. But let's start from the beginning. Bill, Rebecca, what is a set-aside?
So Mona, 7.1% of all visas are for the EB-5 program. Just assuming that there are 10,000 visas, there are three categories of investments that enable or entitle an investor to one of these reserved visas. They could be in a rural area or a high unemployment area or outside of any area in an infrastructure project. And those are the three categories that investors are able to qualify for one of these reserve visas.
Right. But what's a rural area? Because I remember somebody saying Central Park in Manhattan might be rural.
Not anymore.
Those were the days.
Yeah, no, not anymore. So, I mean, it's back to the old definition of rural. It's an area outside of an MSA and outside of a city or town of 20,000 people. So it's got to be a really rural area, especially outside of an MSA.
Yeah. But I think where we're going to see the real controversy is the second category, which is the high unemployment area, where there's 10% set aside, which is roughly about 1,000 visas for this new set aside category. This is where developers, because we're getting a lot of developers who are so excited about this, because their expectations is that we're going to have, you know, especially for China, they think it's, you know, it's going to open up a floodgate of investors for this category.
Yeah, Bill, we're getting bombarded with Chinese inquiries. I don't know if you are, because many of your projects, I think most of your projects are in TEAs, right?
Oh, all of them. Right. All of them.
Yeah, because most all your projects are upstate New York.
They're all throughout New York, but they're always in a TEA, and they've always to date been in a high unemployment area. And so all of our new projects were likely to be in a high unemployment area or in a rural area.
So the high unemployment, let's just talk about this for a second. I know we're not economists, and we will have our economists back on to talk about this. Sometimes it's obvious what an area is which is high unemployment. But I remember just recently we looking at a census tract where one end was a TEA and one end wasn't. How is that possible?
A census tract either is or isn't in a high unemployment area. And so it can be as a standalone census tract at 150% of the national unemployment average. But in addition to that, it's any or all of the adjoining or adjacent census tracts with their combined average unemployment at least 150% of the national average.
Yes. It's not the old approach where, again, one, the state is not giving the high unemployment area. It's going to be based on USCIS giving this or the Department of State. And two, it has to be, as you mentioned, Bill, contiguous. So it has to touch the census tract and it has to go in that donut shape. So it's not any and all census tracts. We have to be very careful on how, the economists will have to be careful on how they're going to show the high unemployment areas.
You know, Bill, do you remember back in 2015, the first time that one of these reform legislations was brought out, there was a huge uproar, especially in Manhattan, because, of course, the Manhattan projects were the ones which were closely threatened. And at that time, the big argument was, it doesn't matter where the project is, the workforce come from TEAs. Is that still the case?
Yeah. So that was a really interesting point. It was based on commuting patterns, right?
Yes.
And that's never been the standard for the EB-5 program. It's really just been unemployment rate of that census tract. And a lot of other permutations were thrown out there as to different ways that you could categorize or classify something as high unemployment. But really, it's just been the high unemployment rate. And so unlike the past, as Rebecca was saying, when the state or another agency would designate the area as a TEA, now it's USCIS that designates. But one benefit is that TEA designation will last 2 years from the filing of the business plan. So that's a good change, and it will take more time. So our economists are going to go ahead and say, you know, that is a TEA, but at the end of the day, it's CIS that makes the decision.
Yeah. Well, for any of our new listeners who are perhaps listening for the first time or maybe this topic for the first time, they're probably still scratching their head and saying, well, we're confused. Why are people excited about this?
Oh, they're excited because this opens up a whole new, for one, they're new categories, and therefore investors who are filing as of today. So it does not relate to those investors that filed prior to March 15th, 2002, when RIA came in, was enacted. So all those who have filed before that are still going to be stuck in backlog, China, for instance, versus if a Chinese applicant applies today under the new regulations, under one of these set-asides, they'd be able to have a visa available right away.
But right now, as of today, every country is current except China, correct?
Under the unreserved category. So under the new set-asides, the three set-asides, rural, high unemployment, or infrastructure, everyone is current.
Bill, everyone is going to run for these three categories. Now, how much are we looking at? We're looking at 20. What is the percentage? 20%?
Yeah, so 20% for rural, so roughly 2,000 a year, 10% for high unemployment, or roughly 1,000 a year, and then 2% for infrastructure projects, regardless of where they're located. So that's 200. So you're at about 3,200, which leaves 6,800 in that, I'll say, general or non-reserved category.
So if I was coming in right now, I would be thinking, if I put in 800 and went for one of these three areas, given the amount of people who want to do that, would I not be better off going and putting a higher amount in and going to the unreserved?
Well, that's a really interesting question. And it's a deep question, because if you think about it, Mona, the question becomes one of, do I believe that one of the reserve categories that I'm going to invest into will become retrogressed by the time, you know, I'm eligible, you know, when I'm actually going to receive a visa in the future? So that's the first, will it become retrogressed? Will it become retrogressed for my country? And mm-hmm. if it becomes retrogressed, what's going to happen to those other 6,800 visas that are available in the non-reserve category? And if I apply in a higher investment amount in a non-reserve category, am I retrogress there? So for example, am I Chinese, which would seem to say there's no way I'm going to do that. But so I think it's a really complicated question, and we're going to need a lot of insight and interpretation from CIS as to exactly how these are handled.
Well, unfortunately, I think it's going to take a long time for them to figure this out. I mean, we're going to have to see how many in the next year or two, how many visas will actually get used in use. How are they going to allocate it? If there is a backlog, I think some of the questions that come out are you going to be able to move from one category to the other? You know, yeah. In EB2 and EB3, you can move categories. EB3 can go up to an EB2, vice versa. Will you be able to do that within the EB5 categories? Let's say, you know, I'm from South Africa and I went into a rural project, but let's say all the visas are used up. Will I be able to then go into the unreserved category because South Africa will not use all the visas within that category? So
no, well, I would say not if you've paid 800,000, because to me, one of the biggest differences is the 800 and non. Am I getting that wrong, Bill?
No, it's a good question. Go ahead.
Yeah, because here's another question, and this is where we have to differentiate, because for an infrastructure project, for instance, they put that for an infrastructure, to me, when I read the rules, it's saying that it doesn't matter where the infrastructure project is located, it's still going to be an $800,000 project.
Right.
Yeah. It comes under the category of infrastructure, not necessarily as anything else.
Exactly.
Yeah.
A lot.
I told you when people were confused. I even spoke to a very, very experienced attorney earlier this morning, and I happened to mention the Bill that you were coming onto the show, and he was like, great, perhaps Bill can teach us all what to do, because we don't know, we're confused.
Now, I would tell him to ask you, Mona. That would be, I would just absolutely punt on that one.
Yeah,
I know. I have to say, when we talked, I think it was you, Rebecca, who said, why implement these policies if everything is going to be backlogged again? It doesn't make sense.
Exactly. And then what do you do thereafter? Am I allowed to? And I understand. But then, you know, you have to look at the investors who filed previously. And is it fair that, okay, those who are filing now, you kind of get the benefit of getting visas available now to you. But what happened to those who filed back in 2017, 2018, who are still waiting for a visa?
Well, I have to still wait.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. But Bill, what is, you know, you're vice president of IIUSA, and we've featured IIUSA a lot on our podcast series. And I'm not showing any bias here, Mark, am I?
No, not at all.
But what is IIUSA's opinion about all of this?
No, that's a really good question, and I wish you had asked me that before this. And can I want to get a lifeline or whatever you do that when you call somebody and ask them. I'm not 100. I was on the public policy call a few minutes ago, and
Absolutely.
So there are a lot of issues left to be determined in the with the RIA, with the RIA, and I know that this is going to be one of them. And I'm not certain if IIUSA has taken a position yet on these things. But I also think that in addition to IIUSA having a lot to think about, so does USCIS and so do the State Department. And I'm sure that they're, you know, it's going to take a lot of work on everybody's part to figure exactly out how exactly this will work.
Well, for anyone who's listening and doesn't even know what IIUSA does, IIUSA is obviously our trade association for regional centers and EB5 generally, but it doesn't include everybody, Bill, does it? And we do need everybody to be on board for all of these issues because it affects everyone.
Mm-hmm. Right. No, I agree with you completely. I mean, IIUSA is open to anyone in the industry that wants to join, but to your point, it's mostly regional centers, developers, attorneys, service providers, et cetera, not a lot of investors. And but it's also going to take a lot of coordination with CIS. And hopefully we're able to convey the business and immigration issues that we see for the EB-5 program as CIS interprets and implements this. So there's a lot to do.
Yeah, well, I'm a big fan of doing letters as opposed to always filing lawsuits. I feel,
yeah. No, I agree with you. It'd be great. So if we can open up a dialogue with CIS, I think that's really the right thing to do, if there's any way.
Yeah.
And we've asked for that for years. So hopefully we'll see.
Okay, so next question that I have for both of you, and this is being asked by our investors all the time. Is there a faster adjudication for anybody who goes into these special categories?
Well, the statute has the three reserve visa categories, TEA, which is high unemployment and rural, and infrastructure. Now, in high unemployment and rural and infrastructure, they both have an $800,000 investment. They both have a certain number of reserve visas. But in the rural, as you're pointing out, it says that there is priority processing of the 526, of the investor's petition. There are a couple of things that are unclear. The first one is, what is priority processing? So CIS still has the authority to process petitions in a way that makes most sense for them to do it, right? But there's this priority concept, but it's not defined. It doesn't state what it is in the law. So that's an ambiguity that's going to have to get figured out. And the second thing I think that's really important is that priority only applies to the investor's petition. It doesn't apply to the business plan. So adjudication of business plans, one would assume, is a first in, first out process. But after that's done, does CIS decide that it's the right way to do it is to then adjudicate all the petitions associated with that? And maybe it's just unclear what priority will mean, at least in my opinion. I mean, Rebecca, what do you think?
I completely agree. I think there's going to be several issues in regards to priority. Also, because in RIA, they also came out with a timeline of when they have to adjudicate these petitions.
That's not until 2024.
Yes. So yeah. We need to understand, does priority mean right now for these categories? Is it only for rural projects? The other issue that I see coming out as well is that we're seeing it for rural projects under the regional center. But what about direct rural projects?
Yeah, that's true.
Yeah, I can't speak to them, but it's definitely for rural. But it's just, I mean, rural regional center projects, but we just don't even know what it means. I mean,
yeah.
I think we've all got the experience of, different types of processings, et cetera, but this is a new one, at least in my book.
Well, going back to the beginning of, is this a good idea or is this a good policy? I have to bring up the point that prior to RIA, that we would come across many, many investors who would not even glance at a rural project or they would always go for urban over rural. Mm-hmm. And in my opinion, this is the one big advantage. For the first time, people are actually looking at rural projects. But of course, Bill, you're going to say something else, but rural projects, the finances are just not the same as urban. Can they still come up to meet the standard?
Well, I think that it's a really interesting question, because you would say that the primary benefit over another is this priority processing. But at the end of the day, I got to tell you, the real key is, when you're doing your diligence on a project, who is operating the project? What is the mm-hmm. regional center? How are they doing? What's their experience? But at the end of the day, it is, what's the likelihood that jobs are going to get created? So you get all your immigration benefits and a green card and whatnot. And then the second is, what's the likelihood of your eventual repayment? I would tell you that it's the same analysis, whether it's rural or urban or high unemployment or it's always the same analysis. Now, I think your point is there are fewer projects, in general, that meet the same standard of the likelihood of jobs created, the likelihood of capital being repaid. Plus, I think that there are just fewer significant or larger rural projects, which generally attracted the capital. But
yeah.
in the coming world, I think you go through the same analysis and you may find that there are many more very good regional rural projects that we didn't know about in the past. So it's a project by project analysis.
I agree. I think, Mona, you and I, for the past few years, we've been telling investors it's, you look at the project itself.
Yeah.
Location can matter. But then we've had clients, you were saying the other day that a client came in and asked you, a project in New York City versus a project in a rural area, and it was more cost effective to have that project in rural.
Yeah, that was the client who was questioning the construction costs. Mm-hmm. Bill, this was really interesting because he was questioning the construction costs of a project, and the developer turned around and said, but if I put this in same project in Manhattan, my construction cost would be four times this. And then suddenly the investor went, oh, I get it. And suddenly everything, sort of the penny dropped. So definitely, you know, those things do matter. But mm-hmm. overall, the feeling towards with investors has always been that they want to invest in somewhere they know, whether it be Miami, Los Angeles, New York, you know?
Yep, totally.
Well, I think that's where I have the bit of confusion, whereas the intent was, yeah, the intent is to have, you know, investors come in and look for the rural areas, right, where it's, where job creation is really needed. But then you throw in the high unemployment area, at which could potentially, we could have projects in New York again or Miami in these big cities that could potentially fall under a high unemployment area. So then would investors end up looking at those types of projects versus the rural projects?
Well, I think it's important because you made a point that they're going to look at. And I think mm-hmm. that the fact that's good about the current construct of the statute is it's going to incentivize people to look at projects.
Yeah.
You might not, you know, in the past, it was easier to find a project in Midtown Manhattan, you know, right or wrong, it mm-hmm. just was. So then you would say, well, why in the world would I go to, you know, a small rural town when I know that I can get one in Midtown Manhattan? But now it's going to enable people, it's going to encourage them to look. So we'll yep. see what it does at the end of the day.
And a classic example, Bill, is a project, it's an old project of yours where I know it's closed, so we can talk about it. It's the Children's Hospital, without giving any names that you have, but your payback was so practical and unique that I thought, wow, you know, people just have that visualization of how something should be, and it, you know, they follow it through rigid lines, and they're not ready to look at different types of projects which actually work in a practical market.
Yeah, I do think that that's important. And I think that it's difficult for investors. And I was speaking with some just this weekend, and they said, how do we find other projects? Well, it's always hard to do that. So I think that people will have an incentive to look more. And we've never had an issue, you know, identifying investors. And I think that once they look at our projects, they've been happy with them. So, you know, that's what we're going to continue to do going forward is identify projects, be they in rural or high unemployment or, you know, hopefully an infrastructure project or two sprinkled in, and then make sure that they're projects that meet their needs and the objectives of the program. That's our objective.
Well, we like to show investors as many projects as possible. Yeah. We like them to ask questions. So we encourage that. We keep telling them, ask us questions. I think we regret it later. Because some of them really do.
Yeah.
Well, they absolutely should look at more than one. 100%.
Yes, I couldn't agree more. You know, you're limiting yourself. And like we said, look at these different types of projects, whether it's rural, high unemployment, infrastructure, or even if it's at the higher amount, take a look at everything and decide for yourself.
Yeah, and that is a good point. I mean, the higher amount isn't that much higher anymore. Mm-hmm. It's 25, you know, roughly 25% versus it was 100% higher in the past. So that'll be interesting to see how many more of the projects go out at the higher investment amount. It'll be interesting to see how that happens.
Bill, I'm going to take you back to IIUSA for a nanosecond. Advocacy goals. With all of this confusion, I know we're asking questions, but if we have to do advocacy, because it just seems like, I'm going to keep repeating this, Sue the Bastard seems to be the quote of the year. But tell me, what are the advocacy goals in the future with regards to this particular area?
Yeah. So IIUSA's initial advocacy goals were basically incorporated in the RIA, which was reauthorization and reform of the program.
Right.
And now that we have a lot of the reforms that are implemented, I think it opens up the EB-5 program to be able to focus more on longer term, larger issues, for example, additional visas and the ability to have more investors and not counting derivatives. You know, there are some really big picture issues that we should focus on now. Doesn't mean, but at the same time, the industry and IIUSA as a leader of the industry needs to also be focused on implementation of the RIA. How is it actually happening? So we have kind of a dual track. The first one is make sure that that law, which was passed, gets implemented in a way that everybody intended. And then there's always unintended consequences of any legislation. Make sure that those get implemented in a way that works for the agency and for the investors and for the projects. But then on a longer term basis, I think it is really to say, we've done what Congress wanted on reform and integrity forms in particular. Now we should be able to go back and, as we see more things in immigration happening over the years, is to request more visas. So that would be my personal opinion. I'm not really speaking for IIUSA, but in my personal opinion, that's what I think the advocacy goals should be.
And is the way to go to lobby Congress or, you know, lobby the IPO?
All of the above. You know, we are, the EB-5 program is a creature of statute.
Yeah,
and we will live and die by Congress and the statutes, et cetera. Mm-hmm. So we have to maintain that. But there's also the administration, whether it's the White House or the agency, whether it's CIS or another agency. If there may be some instances with the State Department. Again, that's over my pay grade. But you have to do all of the above. And with mayors and with towns and with cities and with states, to say to them, make sure that your members of Congress know how good this program is. So I think it's all of the above, Mona.
Yeah, I couldn't agree with you more about the mayors and stuff, because for the first time again, small towns, emerging towns in the middle of the country are suddenly becoming interested in EB-5 as a source. So We're going to see a lot of action moving forward. Rebecca, have we seen a slowdown, in interest?
No. With the EB-5 program, I think obviously everyone needed to kind of wrap their heads around and figure it out. But we're seeing a lot of interest moving forward, whether it's the 800,000. At first, I think a lot of clients were nervous whether or not, investors would be coming in. But I don't know. I think it's not going to be what we had before with an influx of thousands and thousands of petitions. But I still
which is not necessarily a bad thing. Not necessarily a bad thing. But Bill,
we're seeing the same thing. We're seeing a tremendous upsurge in interest. And I think a lot of that is due to the reauthorization of the program.
Yeah.
I think a lot of people at the end of, last June paused. And then as you got into once the program sunset, everybody said, forget about it. So I think that there is quite a bit of pent up interest in the program again, now that we're reauthorized. And also, because there's that provision in the statute that says if you apply, if you file for the program, you have the right to continue through regardless of a future sunset. So it's really important that the investor protections in this bill are really good.
But I have noticed one thing, though, given a choice, less people are looking at direct and more are feeling the comfort zone with a regional center project.
Yeah, I would agree. I think the fact that a direct can now only be a single investor, et cetera,
yes.
I think it just makes a lot more sense that it be a regional center project, especially, once you have two investors, it effectively is. So
security side as well, Mona, because with direct, we were seeing before a lot of people did not want to have a PPM.
Yeah.
And I think moving forward, that's going to be important.
Yeah, no, the securities, definitely the new securities laws or the new enhancements with integrity measures are certainly going to make a difference.
Yeah, the regional centers obviously benefit from economies of scale, where the direct didn't. Before, it was just a few investors. Now you're limited to just one investor only. So that investor not only has to pay for the investment, but all the logistics and upfront everything that goes along with EB-5, right?
Rebecca, Mark is being paying attention.
I know.
Woo-hoo, I passed my test.
I think what was intended previously was the entrepreneurial aspect of the direct and the standalones. We're still getting direct, but we'll see more of those who want to do their own types of projects.
My issue here is that, and people still comment on it, that one of the objections, back in the day to the EB-5 program, even getting reauthorized, was that certain members of Congress would say, this is not buy a green card. And we would argue nobody is just buying a green card. There's a lot which goes into an EB-5 project and an EB-5 investor. And I would say, Bill, even trying to choose and doing your due diligence in the beginning and choosing the right project and being patient and waiting, even if you, for example, are handling the project, that's work in itself.
Yeah, no. And I have to tell you something. When people say you're buying a green card or you're buying citizenship, I think it's really critical to respond and say, look, if people could just buy a green card or citizenship, they would pay 10 times as much. There's just, it's, that just does not happen. Rather, mm-hmm. they have to make an at-risk investment, and that at-risk investment has to create at least 10 new jobs to U.S. jobs for that investor. There's no way you could call that buying anything. So it's an investment, and it's an investment that has to pay off for the United States of America, or the person, he or she and their family, does not receive the immigration benefits and may also lose that investment, which is an at-risk investment. So I always get a little worked up when someone says you're buying a green card. So you can kind of tell, but I could ramble on.
You're right, Bill. And after all, that is the whole point of the EB-5 program, right? Is to invest in America, create jobs, develop infrastructure, and that way we can all benefit from those rewards together. Thank you for coming back on EB-5 Investment Voice.
Thank you so much, Mona, Rebecca, and Mark. This has been really terrific.
Thank you for being with us today on EB-5 Investment Voice. The topics presented in this podcast is informational in nature and is not to be taken as specific legal advice. If you have questions on the topics presented in this episode or other investment immigration needs, please contact Mona Shaw & Associates. Mona and her attorney staff can be reached at mshawlaw.com. That's mshahlaw.com. Make sure you don't miss our next episode focusing on a different aspect of the EB-5 program by subscribing to the podcast. While you're at it, leave us a rating on iTunes. If you really found this episode valuable, share it with someone else that could benefit from this information. Until then, I'll see you on the next episode of EB-5 Investment Voice.